Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I am Leona Abraham Brando, host for Blog Talk Radio, Shedding Light. Psychosocial therapist Marion Jacobs is back with us today to speak on issues in America which have resulted in the downfall of individuals in the prisons, communities, on the streets, in the homeless shelters, and beyond. She will also be speaking more about her recently published book, which is currently being translated from Dutch to English and will be ready for distribution in the new year of 2023. So please welcome Marion Jacobs. Marion, are you on with us?
Hello, Leona. Here I am. I am on.
How are you today?
I am fine. How are you?
Good. I want to thank you for being on with us again, and I really look forward to an update on everything that you've been doing. So, can you please introduce yourself a little bit more to the audience for those who do not know you, but I'm sure everyone is very familiar with you and your work by now. You've done a lot in the United States as well as in the Netherlands.
Thank you, Leona. Yes, I live in the Netherlands, and in my country I work with incarcerated people. I also have visited a prison in Florida, United States, and in the system I saw a lot of things that are going wrong, that are harming the human values of people, and I decided to write a book about it. The book is now it's printed, so it's ready to be published, and it will be translated in English, as you said. And and you know that American people also get access to the book. And yes, that's what I wanted to say.
I was also going to ask you to let the audience know about the film, that the documentary that you had been in, and where they can see that. And that was the Death Row Angels?
Yeah, the film is it's a documentary, and it's called, as you say, it's called Death Row Angels. And the film is about European women who get involved with men on death row in Texas. I was the only exception in the film because the man I was involved with has a life sentence in Florida. And the documentary shows what motivates these women to become involved in these relationships, and what the background is of these women. So it's mostly about women. And there's also my personal story. From my story, I got involved also with the system itself. Before I got involved, I didn't know anything about incarceration, prisoners, whatever. So I never thought about it. But because of this relationship or friendship or whatever you call it, I started to think about what does it mean to be incarcerated, and what does it mean when you have committed a crime, and what is restorative justice. So I got involved in a completely different world, as I know, and from there everything, you know, moved on, like you know, doing my research, using my research in the light of my master philosophy, and writing my thesis about it and writing my book about it.
You've done an awful lot throughout the years that I've known you, and I can't imagine how you find the time or the rest or whatever, because you started out, I believe, with the Deeper Justice. And can you explain a little bit about Deeper Justice?
Yes. From this whole adventure in Florida, when I got involved with this man, I wanted to understand the reality from where he was writing me. I don't have contact with him anymore because he stays a dangerous man, and I had to figure that out. But because I wanted to understand who this man was, I had to understand the system. And I also got involved with restorative justice. And I realized that you know, when you look at the process of restorative justice, then you see the process of healing between an offender and a victim. But I realized that before somebody who has committed a crime can do healing towards the victim, he first has to heal himself, inside himself. And that's what I call deeper justice. So in my own work with incarcerated people here, I first go to the offender himself and I want to understand who that person is, what has happened in the life of this person, what led to the crime, who was this person during the crime, what were his intentions. There are a lot of questions that I have. And because I have these questions, the offender starts to think about himself. And then he, you know, grows to more self-insight of who he is, what responsibility means to him, and how he can develop responsibility, empathy, and all that, because that makes a human human. And that's what has to be restored, you know, after having committed a crime. So I call it deeper justice because it means that somebody is able to do deeper justice to his own nature in himself. And that's the start of the real healing. And only after that process of healing on this deeper level inside oneself, one can heal something towards the victim. But this is a step that's often neglected. Often we want to punish and we want revenge, and that's all based on emotions. And then we expect from nowhere that the offender starts to feel remorse. But he cannot feel remorse or responsibility if he does not have any insight in what has happened and who he is. So the start is, you know, the incarcerated person himself or herself, of course. It also can be a woman. And I see that this is very needed, and this process is neglected too many times. We do have, and in the United States you do have rehabilitation programs, but it does not reach enough. It's not enough, because that's why you have a lot of people in prison, and that's why you have a high recidivism number. So that's what I want to put in light, because for me, everything is connected to human values. My book is about human values, and we have to start a discussion much more about when we incarcerate people the way we do. What does it say about the human values of a person? That discussion is lacking too much. We talk about punishment, incarceration, we talk about bad people and all that, but we don't talk enough about what are the human values and why are these values at stake. So something in the system, in the system is very wrong, because we don't talk about this enough.
You know, that's one of the things I find so unique about you, Mariam, and this is why I love having you on the show. You, first of all, people right now in the United States, the legislative members talk about, you know, criminal justice reform, prison reform, but a lot of them have never been in the prison or have not been in the prisons to meet with the prisoners. You are an advocate, an author, a psychosocial therapist, someone that has actually gotten involved in the prison system, in the criminal justice system, and everything that you talk about is something that you didn't hear about or just do the research on, but you actually dove right into it to find these issues and to see all these issues. People, they stereotype prisoners, and in your words, in the work that you've done, you have stated yourself that people are different. Everyone behind those prison walls has a different circumstance, situation, and they're all different. And that's why Mariam Jacobs is not just a psychosocial therapist. She is not just an author, but she has actually worked in the prisons. She has been around incarcerated individuals, and she lets everyone know about these issues. And I hope and pray that everyone listening will take something from her interview today, as well as in the past, and as well as in the future, to take her information, to take her experiences, and take her words, and do something with it. Learn more about the criminal justice system. Learn about individuals that are incarcerated and their different issues. Don't stereotype, but learn more about them. And Mariam, I want you to talk more about the work that you've been doing recently and what your thoughts are about the comparison, as you mentioned in previous interviews, the comparison between prisons in the Netherlands, in Europe, and in the United States.
I think the biggest differences you see in Northern Europe and the United States, especially Norway, that's the best example, of course, of how it should be. What I think what is missing is that we don't ask questions to the prisoners. So we do have these assumptions in our heads, and we do have these pictures in our heads of a prisoner as a bad person who committed a crime. And we don't try enough to get to know the whole person. And the only way you can get to know a prisoner is to ask him questions about who he is. And let him talk, let him explain who he is, where he comes from, and why he committed the crime, and what has happened on his life path. That's what we do more here in Northern Europe, and especially you see it a lot in Norway. That's I think the best example. And another thing is what is important is that if people commit a crime in a society, then the offender, of course, he is responsible for the crimes that he has committed. But I think the society is responsible for asking itself the question, how do we function as a society that this can happen? So a society should be also be critical to itself, because a crime does not only say something about the prisoner, but it also says something about society. So years ago, it's a long time ago, you had this huge crime in Norway from this man, Andries Breivik. He killed, I don't know, 90 young people. And he has a life sentence, but after 25 years, he is evaluated and they are going to see if he has changed. So he might get a second chance if he has really changed. If he cannot change and he will maintain endangered, and he will stay in prison. So when he does not get out, it's not because of revenge, but that then it is because he is not able to function in society on a safe way. That's another intention, as what you see in the United States. Another thing what you see in Norway is that society, people in society, also the victims, the parents of the young victims that were killed by this man, they said that they wanted to look at themselves as a society and see what it has gone wrong in society that this could take place. That speaks about a very high consciousness, and that speaks about a people who is not afraid to look at itself and be critical also at themselves and see what they can do to change society in a way that this cannot occur anymore. So, and that's true restorative justice. Restorative justice is about three sides, three parties. It's the offender, it's the victim, and it is the society.
It's interesting.
And I think what you see in the United States is that the crime is convicted, not a person. It means that the person is invisible to the juridical system. It's only the crimes that they see, but they neglect that they don't see that there is a whole person behind that. And everybody has his own stories. I mean, in the Netherlands, I also talk with people who have committed a murder or have done other awful things. But when I talk to them, they are human beings like I am, with their own issues, with their own dreams, with their own, you know, nobody gets born and has this idea that he, in the future, he wants to be a criminal. Nobody chooses to become a criminal. That's not a free choice. So he is responsible and he has to learn to feel remorseful, but that's a process. You cannot force that. And first you have to try to heal the damage that has been done in the roots of a person, because it's very deep.
You know, I think if people do, if people look at it the way you look at it, the way you, you know, theorize it, it's almost as though people in society today, they're so busy judging people, they don't even know, rather than to dig deeper into the causes, but also to judge to a point where they don't want to even try to help an individual that has committed a crime. But yet there's so many people out in society that have committed crimes that haven't gotten caught. And they forget that they have, in some way or another, they have done some form of injustice. And one of the injustices is with the incarcerated, judging them without a cause, that they don't know the person, individual. So these are some of the issues. Mass incarceration, and I say this all the time, in the United States, if these legislative members were to come up with these bills and come up with these ideas of establishing more long-term residential treatment facilities and put these people that are sick into these facilities rather than into the prisons, I don't believe we would have mass incarceration. I was watching the news the other day, and I've seen this before, where this individual killed his own mother and his sister, and a neighbor tried to step in, and she was also stabbed. They weren't killed. They were stabbed. They are in the hospital, two seriously harmed. The other one is recovering. But these are some issues that they mentioned, that this person had psychological issues. But this person will go to prison. We know for a fact that we have a government in the United States of America that won't look at this as meaning that this person needs to be hospitalized, as with so many others with the 2.3 million incarcerated in the U.S. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, what I think, what you see in the United States is that when people cannot cope with society and get when people have trauma issues, psychiatric issues, or they simply are poor, or they have an addiction, they cannot walk in the line that is expected. And when they cannot walk in the line, they are thrown into prison. They are living in the streets, or they are thrown into prison. So there is no differentiation in the causes of crime or background information. It's, or, you know, you have one big prison and everything is thrown in there, who gives problems because he cannot cope with the harshness of society, because the society is very harsh and very biased. And I think, you know, when you would have decent health care, that you do have decent health care, but it's not accessible for everyone. So if health care would be accessible for everyone, if you would have decent forensic psychiatric hospitals, when you would have these hospitals for people who can, who needs to cure from addictions, then you would only have a small population in prison. And in the past, you had that before mass incarceration, there was a whole different situation in your country. But I believe it was in the 70s that they closed a lot of psychiatric hospitals, and because they wanted to save money. So they sent the people with new medications that were developed in laboratories. They sent them on the streets with these medications, but without any network, without any help. So these people, they got into trouble and ended up in prison. So they went from a psych ward to prison. And that's, well, that's so inhumane. I mean, you know, I wrote my book about human values. Well, this is an example of how human values can be even absent, because this is, you know, it's like it's not about human beings anymore. And that's a big problem. Money is a very big problem. I think if I would have $1 million now, I could have my loved one, you know who that is, I could have him out of prison because I would have money. So a lot of it is about money and not about human life.
Exactly. There's controversy going on right now, even in Massachusetts, with the governor. He is trying to pardon a family who ran a daycare and apparently abused the children sexually throughout the time. And the relatives of these abused children are really upset. They were on the news the other day, furious that the governor would even consider releasing them or giving them a pardon. These are some of the things that I look at some of these things as it's who you know and, you know, what you have. And that's one of the big issues is money talks and what do they say walks? These are issues that occur in the United States.
Yeah, and I think what another thing is that it's violence is very glorified, and you have this in your country. A lot of people have this, I don't know how to say it, but they have this idea of, you know, this gun story of the Second Amendment, and amendments are given by God, and you know God told us we need the freedom to carry guns and all that, you know, it's also a big part. And and also even the prison, you know, has become glorified. If you look at all these films, there are a lot of, well, quote-unquote documentaries. I don't call them documentaries, but officially they are called documentaries. But, you know, where you see how prison life also is glorified, you know, as if it's something wonderful instead of a, you know, horrifying hell where you have to try to survive. And I think there is a lot of judgment. You know, people are judged easily. And a lot of people are very busy with making money and getting rich. There's a lot of emotions. Your country is very much based on emotions. You know, American exceptionalism is a part of it. And it's not everybody who thinks this way, but a big part of thinks this way. When you look at the prison system, it's for a big part, it's based on emotions. And I mean, you know, angriness, by being biased, judgment. That's the good man. That's a bad man. But what is a bad person? We all have a good and a bad part, you know. And the line between people in prison and outside prison, that line between us, that wall is very thin. We are no different from them, and they are not no different from us. But you know, they walked a path, and they had their issues, what led to the crime. And what a lot of people see, think they see, is a lot of crimes in prison, and they forget that there are not only crimes in prison, but it's people who are in prison. There is no justification to have this prison system that you have in the United States. Never.
Yeah.
I don't care what somebody has done. There has to be a punishment, but there also has to be the punishment should be rehabilitation. That's the only answer. And I think when somebody commits a crime, at that moment, he doesn't honor the human values of the victim. So if he's incarcerated, society or the penal system should create an environment that he learns how to deal with human values. But because he's punished even more and the punishment never stops, he cannot learn anything about human values. So he cannot rehabilitate and he cannot change. And he only you know, he only becomes worse. I would become very bad, I think, when I would be in prison, but because I would not have a positive example. You know, my traumas would maintain, my issues would maintain, and nothing would change. So it's a dead end. The United States prison system is a dead end for the individuals and their families, and it's only a positive thing for people who make money out of it.
And I believe that's why we have mass incarceration, and we have a high, very high recidivism rate. As you say, they come out, people come out of prison, they've been treated so poorly, many of them, that they come out not rehabilitated, but in worse conditions, in worse conditions. I wanted to say too, Marian, you're from Europe, you're from the Netherlands, and one of the things I find with the United States of America, they haven't been through the traumas and the issues that many people have gone through throughout the country, throughout the world. And when I traveled, before traveling, I came from a small town on Cape Cod in Massachusetts, and I thought going over the bridge to go into Boston, the cities or whatever, was like going to another country until I traveled. When I traveled to all these countries, I found that the United States of America is just a little pebble on the beach. It's not as big as people think. It's not as powerful as people think. And what happens is in other countries, there have been so many wars that people have gotten used to a lot of the trials, the tribulations that they've had in their countries. They get over it. If something happens in this country, it is so, it's not only exaggerated sometimes, but it's also not blown out of proportion, but it continues. It's on the news. It doesn't just go on the news for a few days or a week. It goes on the news for months and months and months. We're still talking and listening to the Boston Marathon. It happened years ago. We're still hearing about that. We're hearing about people that have died, law enforcement that have died years ago. These people take on a job. They wear a uniform. They take on a job. And this, when something happens, this is part of the job that they've taken on. When other people in the communities die, you don't hear about them. But if somebody in uniform or somebody with wealth or celebrity or athlete, they drag it on for months and months and months. And I don't see where this is any beneficial to anyone. I've heard and I've seen so many people who have lost their loved ones in other countries, and they have to deal with it. And look at, we just exchanged a very dangerous prisoner in the United States for an athlete. And that was the Grainer case. And everybody's thankful she's home. But at the same time, the person that they released was violent, very dangerous, and from Russia. But yet we have people in the United States prisons who have done less, that are stuck in the prisons, but we have a president that's going to release a very violent and dangerous person to bring home one person while there's still a person over there that got 16 years. He's a military person fighting for the United States. And these are the kind of things that go on in the United States. But if they can release violent prisoners from other countries that are in the United States prisons, then they should be able to consider releasing a lot of these people that are in prison that have done less.
Yeah, I think I could not hear everything because sometimes you fell, your voice fell away. But the thing is that in your prison system, people are not evaluated. They might be evaluated, but not on the right way, because that's why you have all these problems.
You know, I have to say,
when you think of, I think what the difference is in your country, when people get a life sentence, it's because of the crime they committed. But in my country, when somebody gets a life sentence, it's not only because of the crime he committed, but also he has been evaluated, and he maintains being evaluated from time to time. because there are a lot of other factors that play a role when somebody commits that crime. And in your country, they only look at the crime itself. And that's why you have all these problems. So we have 25 people in the Netherlands who have a life sentence, but that's because they show that they maintain a danger. And my loved one, he could be released years ago because he's not a danger. But the man I knew in Florida, he will always be a danger because he has psychiatric, he has a bipolar disorder. He really has disorders. And a disorder is very difficult to heal. You cannot heal from a disorder. So mm-hmm. He has some very serious disorders. So he will maintain a danger. So we have these people here too. So, but that's also why we have psychiatric, forensic psychiatric hospitals where people get evaluated. And when they maintain a danger, then they cannot be released. But that's a solid reason. That makes sense. But only, you know, keeping somebody incarcerated for the rest of his life without evaluating that person, so see if he has changed, see if he has been, he has been going through rehabilitation programs and all that, then the punishment becomes revenge. And that's what's happening in your country. It's an ongoing revenge. So prisoners cannot fight against it because they are condemned for the rest of their lives. So whatever, doesn't matter what they do. You know, they can try to change themselves and go to church and do the best programs they can do. But if they don't get another choice, a chance, why would they do that? I mean, yeah. you are doomed for the rest of your life, you know.
Yeah. And the thing is, they have the problem with the prison system as well, is that they, like, I actually had a former prisoner who was serving life and his aunt over to my home for dinner. And this individual was a Marine. He was a Marine that was home on leave. And the day or two before he was supposed to go back, he ran into some high school friends that wanted to go, they were going to a party, so he invited him to go along, and he went. When he got there, there was a mob, and this was a racial issue. The thing that bothers me the most is there was a racial issue between colors, people of color. A gang of Cape Verdeans went after these three individuals, this Marine and two of his friends that went to this party. When they tried to leave, to get away from this crowd, the Marine was licensed to carry a firearm because he was an MP. And his friend went to drive away off the sidewalk, and the car jerked just as this individual went to shoot his gun in the air to scatter the mob. And the gun went off into the crowd. And this person ended up getting a life without parole. However, throughout the years, with all the support he was able to gain, all the support that he had for this one offense, he was able to be released recently. This was within the last several months. This is the way they need to look at things, is, as you say, the causes, because these things...
Yeah, and the changes that somebody can make in his personality... So if somebody gets incarcerated and he gets a punishment, let's say a life sentence or 20 years or 10 years or whatever, and he can go through a process of rehabilitation and he gets evaluated from time to time, then he has, you know, he should have a chance to rehabilitate and then get a second chance in society. You have to heal them. You know, yeah. Society and the penal system, they should be an example for the prisoners, the good example. If the prisoners did not, if the prisoner did made a, this mistake and did it wrong and he goes to prison, then the prison should be the good example so the prisoner can learn from that good example how he has to deal with his life. It's as simple as that. And then you would have then you would not have mass incarceration. Then you only would have prisons for people who are really intrinsic bad. There are some people who cannot be rehabilitated. We have them too in the Netherlands, but we are talking about 25 people.
25.
So yeah, but then, you know, if somebody will be in prison for the rest of his life because he really is not able or capable of changing himself, then it makes sense to keep somebody in prison and even then the conditions in the prisons should be human.
Exactly.
And that's not what's happening in the United States, because, you know, when I wrote my book, and I told this before, when I entered the prison system in Florida, I fell back in my memory 20 years earlier that I was visiting Auschwitz, and I had the same feeling, because both the concentration camps and the United States prison system, if you enter these systems, you feel that there are no human values present. It's absent, and it's so cold and so evil. So difficult to explain, but, you know, if you go to a place where are no human values, it's so dead. It's difficult to explain it, because then there is also no respect, no humanity, but there are all these people living in there.
I think you said it right. Like, they're like concentration camps in the United States prisons. And if everybody, I'm sure people have even seen it on television, what concentration camps look like. This is pretty much the same in the United States. As you mentioned, the differences between the prisons in the United States compared to the prisons in other countries, they're even the housing units are so different from what I understand.
Yeah. Yeah, when you look at you can look at photos on Google Pictures, you can see photos of prisons here, and the cells are more like rooms. It's not really cells, you know. Of course they are locked up. The door is locked, but they have their own television. They have a normal bed, not a bunk, but a bed. They have their own toilet, their own shower. It's a complete different situation. I mean, there are prisons, and I think it's not every prison in the United States, but there are prisons that even when a prisoner has to go to the bathroom and he sits on the toilet, everybody can see him. That's so dehumanizing.
Mm.
You know, imagine that for 20 years, you know, every time you go to, you sit on your toilet, and your neighbors can see you. I mean, we cannot even imagine how it would be, because it's so dehumanizing. There's no privacy at all. There is a 24 hours, you know, for 24 hours a day, there are these eyes of the guards, you know, pointed to the prisoners. We cannot imagine how that looks like, what it is, but it is inhumane, 100% inhumane.
And it does not
rehabilitate. What's the goal of that? Safety? It's always about security. Safety? Is that safe? No, it's not safe, because you still have mass incarceration. You still have this high number of recidivism. You have these fights in prison. You have these riots in prison. You have all this drug abuse in prison. So no privacy doesn't work. It's not going better in the prisons if there is no privacy. So it's useless. There are a lot of rules in prison, just for the rules, not for the people, but just, you know, for the rules. They are random. There are so many rules that have no meaning at all. It's only to tease prisoners, you know, to stay in power over the prisoners, because that's what they want. Overpowering the prisoners. Because a lot of rules are simply random. They have no goal. They serve nobody and nothing.
Yeah. We have a caller, but before I ask who it is, I just want to say one thing. Talking about inhumane conditions, talking about a lot of these things, I find that these rules that you talk about, I find a lot of times when we hear of riots in the prisons, we hear of a lot of things going on, the hunger strikes. These prisoners are trying to get a message out. They're trying to let people know, we need somebody to help us. We need somebody to look at what's going on inside. And unfortunately, when these things don't happen, they strike out. They have nowhere to go. You know, they have nowhere to vent, and they're not getting the help. So they end up, I think a lot of times they end up going against each other because they have no one that's listening. But I'd like to find out, we have a caller, 404. Do you want to state your name, please?
Yes, Ibrahim Musa Assad.
How are you, Ibrahim?
I'm good.
Would you like to, please do.
Yeah, I would. I did 10 years in Massachusetts from 1978 to about... I'm a little less than 10 years inside the prison and on parole a combination of 20 years to 93 when I was paroled, 93, 94. I went in prison during one of the most volatile times. I don't know if y'all remember I've been in upstate New York where I arrived on where they killed the guards and also the prisoners.
Attica,
that's right.
Yeah.
That was right about that time, or maybe a little after, but I forget. But anyway, the sea way the prison system grew and developed, it appeared more humane. It almost looked like elementary schools and high schools.
Which prison was that?
Well, I was in Walpole. And Walpole, at that time, they had murder operating. Oh, you had to deal with... In a military, the first killing I seen was somebody in a secure lockdown, gate lockdown, individual cells. Somebody was attacked and stabbed and killed and threw off the third tier to the floor. And the guard stepped out the gate and banged the gate three times. The only way you could get out your cell was through that network of using electronic unlocking the cells individually or collectively. Now, there could be some, you know, okey-doke going on. But it was a time when the officers were trying to stop people from being educated and everything, trying to better their lives. I forgot what they call it, rehabilitation. And the old guard didn't like that, so they concocted and drugs and everything of having those flags go off. And then when I went to the so-called middle section of Walpole, they were burning bodies. They were burning people. You name it. You know, and I smelled burning flesh. And then I took the advice of a Muslim guy. He told me about I should go and try to go to school and tell me that's what I want to do. So I went out to Norfolk, which is more like a college campus. You know, wear your own clothes, get your own food. But that was pre the drug war, the crack wars, you know. And then I went to the other place. I got middle security where we had, and I was able to unite with the Irish, Whitey Boys, the Italians, and the Puerto Ricans and the black people, we got united a little bit. That caused a fear, so they took me out, put me in another prison to open up another prison, and finally released me to a mental security prison, which was just like being out there in Hollywood, you know what I mean, with Italian mafia and so forth and so on. I made the grade. But anyway, the hard part is to see that when I was talking to my friends as a crack war, started locking people up in the 90s, oh, my God, that changed. All those cells became, two and four people in a cell. You know, it was already overpacked with one apiece with all the services and facilities. You know, so now everything becomes a, critical, and you got blood and violence. And drugs is easily let in. If it was just by visitors, then they could stop that easily. But it's brought in by, guards and stuff.
That's it.
Now, as far as mass incarceration, my little experience with it. But now going on to a public, I don't believe in public control prisons. I think that is a clear statement of this is where that is all about, the cash, right? We saving the state, or we're charging the state, and the state is incurring, you know, exorbitant amounts of money. And that money going feeding back to the judges, lawyers, and district attorney, and everybody like that, right? In one way or another, it's being fed back. But however, I do believe that for any man that might possibly get out of prison or live his life in prison, I do think vocation is a good thing. I learned machine tool technology, and I came out as a prototype machinist for a while, right? And also and some other things. You know, I went to college, went to one of my prestigious colleges in Massachusetts, and, you know, gained education in business and all that kind of thing, right, which helped me spur my first two businesses. Which is something I was doing anyway out there in the street, but I just turned it into a more profitable enterprise. But however, I think people need to learn trades and do things. We have a problem with that. And since they throw someone in jail, at least you can pick up something besides your next crime or getting hooked up with the wrong hookups, you know, and out there throwing bricks, you know, committing crime will put you right back in. That revolving door is a death trap, because the only thing I like to say this last. I know I kind of lump things in together, but that's me. But from cradle to grave, and once you get in, you know, I don't care if it's for 6 months, if you're doing a five-year bit or more and you're going to the state house, whether it's a couple of months or a thousand years, you're going there for death. That's death sentence, period. And like in Georgia, Florida, Massachusetts, Alabama, Mississippi, Texas, these days I wrote those in Texas, got to get out. You know, you can die one way or another. You can die on a bull, or you can die living your life rotting away in prison. You know what I mean? So, you know, so those are the most horrendous things I can think of, you know, that I knew and seen in my life. I heard or met people from those institutions, you know. So, yeah,
I would love to have you come back on another time, too, because you've been there and done it. Walpole, they're trying, right now, they're talking about closing Walpole down within the next, between now and the next year or two, because first of all, the Walpole is old, is very old facility, and secondly, yes. Walpole was one of the worst prisons in Massachusetts. So many people did die in that prison. So many things happened in that prison. And I, what you're saying, I know. I was doing national work with New Vision Organization before stepping down in 2014, and I'll tell you, we worked with prisoners in every state throughout the country. And Massachusetts is no, everybody might think it's a picnic, but it's not. Believe me, they just smile in the faces and they do their dirt in the back with everybody. But anyway, I want to have you come back on again too, because what you're saying, and Marion, please give us some feedback on what Abraham was just saying.
Yeah, I could not hear everything, but I believe that I heard that in the 1990s it got worse, right?
Yes, yes.
Did it also have to do with the, I believe it was in 1994 that the three strikes law became amended?
Yeah, that was out of California.
I think that mass incarceration became very huge because of that law. Under Clinton, right?
Yeah. Yes.
You know, I wanted to say, too, Governor Dukakis, when he was running for president, he lost it because there was a prisoner, Willie Horton, he released. And Willie Horton, when he came out, apparently...
Yeah, Willie Horton. I was in. Go ahead.
That's why I was just mentioning it. And that's ever since then, that's when the harsh on crime and all this came about. But Marion also talked about the corporations making money off of modern day slavery as well.
Yeah. But
Hello?
Okay. Point about the first story, that anybody could get a furlough, even lifetime prisoners, you know, they were allowed furloughs. And not just for, just for the reason, but they qualified, been there quite a few years, they would get furloughed to go home for a couple of days, you know? So Willie Horton had the sponsor, and I used to run part of the fellowship program. And one of the sponsors had developed out of the fellowship program, and he went to the home of this lady and raped her daughter and killed her daughter. And then right there, they took all the lifers, even the ones that was in minimum security joints, and also pre-release them, they put them right back behind the wall. And some of them were the best people that you could ever possibly have to have in a prison, any kind of release environment, because they were the backbone of, believe it or not, lifers and long-termers are the backbone of a prison. They keep it solid, keep it straight, or make it crazy. And, you know, so, yeah, I remember that story. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but that's what you see. And that's so sad, because this man made this huge mistake, but the whole population had to suffer from it.
Yeah.
Everybody got punished. Everybody got punished.
Kitty Dawkins was in a group that helped prisoners. It was called a fellowship program out of Norfolk. It was next door to Walthall. And then they called Cedar Junction. Bobo Cedar Junction now, but okay, but I'll back down. I'll let y'all finish. I'll listen in.
Well, it's interesting to listen to you, because you know how it is. You have been inside.
Now, Abraham, were you familiar with Susan Baranowski when you were in prison? Or was it?
Yeah, she was a college professor, wasn't she? She kept a UMass or something like that.
Who's that?
You say Susan Baranowski.
No, Susan Baranowski, the prison, the maximum prison.
No, I thought okay, back in the 70s, there was one that was a college professor or helping guys get college credits from UMass, University of Mass in Norfolk. That's the only one I could think of by that
name. Was it a man, a guy?
No, it was a lady. She was kind of medium height, about 5'6", 5'7". She was heavy set.
No, this
dirty blonde head.
This is a maximum secure prison in Shirley in Lancaster, Massachusetts.
Oh, I know about Shirley. I am open that up.
are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, y'all open up Shirley, MCI Shirley. I was there when it first opened. A priest named Father Texar helped me with some outside programs, and I helped start the educational program with Boston University up there.
Oh, okay.
Professor Maris Elizabeth Barker and a bunch of people doing a college from Boston University and UMass that was helping get everything from getting into college, you know, up to getting a bachelor's degree for free.
Mm-hmm.
You stay with it, you know.
That's what they need more of. That's what Marion was talking about, too, programs. And I myself don't think that medical providers should be contracted with the Department of Corrections. I think that they need to have independent providers, medical providers going in. And Donna Winnett from Families, Friends, and Individuals for Mentally Ill, she's been trying to, with her committee and others, trying to make it possible for places like Mass General Hospital and others to be able to go in independently and help these incarcerated individuals and psychologically as well.
Yeah, it should. I mean, if you think about it, when I tell people about my experience, it was as bad as it was back, like when I started getting in the 90s and 2000s. But it was horrible, you know. You're right in the cell, you're locked up, you can't go no place. You smell somebody's burning flesh right down the hall. Somebody you might have bumped into, you know, you see in the dining hall or whatever, or the movie theater. And, you want to win your time, but we're going to cross, or who's going to go offer you protection? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And how you gonna get the money to pay what you got to pay? And but I tell you, you know, that's just like anything else. You've been there 5 years, and I've seen this a lot. You come down when you're about 17, 18. You been there 5 years, 10 years. You just like you were 17, 18. Your whole mindset, your whole lifestyle. But you mature and harden from the violence, and no consideration for a person's life. You know, just to have one person to just, you know, we've had outreach program. We have victims that would come in and just concerned citizens just come in and just speak with inmates. It was called Fellowship Program. I ran that for a couple of years. And it was just so different to see people that come in with a hard attitude about inmates. And then after a couple of months, you know, they signed with inmates. They try to get help or justice for the inmates, even help them try to, you know, to get out of prison to get the education or something like that, you know. And so, you know, there were good things and bad things, too. That's how Willie Horton got involved with his people. You know, good and bad things. I could tell people that when they came in. I said, you know, everybody deserves an affection. But just the simple thing, somebody care about you, send you a card,
when you're in there, your family deserted you for good reason or no reason.
Exactly. No reason.
You know, the lawyer, you can't get enough money to pay the lawyer. He's counting you, try to get a little penny you got, you know, and just like, you know, give you a couple of cents an hour when you're shot or something like that. Just be about getting a commissary. You know, that means something, you know. In fact, you get commissary, TV, steaks, anything you want, commissary. You know what I mean? And you're sitting around eating, you know, you know, like a
mashed potatoes and rice, anything to fatten you up.
What do you call that? The pot, the mashed potatoes and meat, something like that. They call it some kind of pie. And then, of course, you got to have Irish food, boiled cabbage and boiled meat. You know, after a while, you know, the ear to go by me, go to me last. No, you speak Irish.
Abraham, I really want to invite you back. We have about 4 minutes, so I want Mariam, can you please again give the audience your information on how they can get in contact with you and how they can find your website? And Abraham, if you want to give any information as well, but I'm hoping that you'll come back on next Wednesday and talk more about this. I belong to a lot of groups on Facebook, and a lot of these people are either family members of incarcerated or their advocates, and a lot of them would love to hear what you have to say about your experiences in these prisons, because they want to know about these prisons. And it's important. I spoke at Pondville Correctional Center years ago. It was on Black History Month. And that was my experience with Pondville. Pondville is for prisoners soon to be released within 2 years. It was awesome. Stephen Duxbury was the supervisor at the time. He was awesome. As I say, there are some guards that are really, really good. And there are some prison officials, but there's a lot of them who are corrupt and deceptive. And if their peers are not going to turn them in and expose them, then they're just as bad as those that are committing those fraudulent and corrupt acts. So, Mariam, you want to give your information, Mariam?
Yes. My website is www.deeperjustice.com. I am on Facebook with my Deeper Justice page. I am also on LinkedIn with my own name, Mariam Jacobs, and I am also with my own name on Instagram. The documentary Death Row Angels can be seen on Amazon Prime, and my book going to be released, I hope, this month or next month, and will be translated in English, and I will keep you informed when that will, when it can be published in English.
Mariam, I want to thank you again. Like, you've been so informative as well, and if anybody's going to talk about anything that goes on in the prison system, I always want to hear it from people who have been in there, people who have experienced it. I have two people on right now that I'm honored to have on with us. One has experienced it personally, and Mariam, you have gone in and experienced it through your visits to the prisons and your work that you're doing in the prison in Netherlands. So Abraham and Mariam, I hope and pray that you'll be on next week, same time, and just let the audience and let everybody out there know what really is prisons are really about. No one should be stereotyped. No one should be abused. No one should be deprived. No one should be neglected. No one should be provoked or harassed or tormented or tortured. No one. And Abraham, when you talked about Walpole years ago and people being burned, I mean, there was a prisoner in Florida. His name was Daryl Rainey. And Daryl Rainey was one of the, you remember that, Mariam?
Yeah, I he's one of my examples in my book.
Tell them about it real quick. Let's hear about it.
Well, that he got in the shower where the temperature only can be regulated on the outside, and then he got in the shower, and then guards, they turned up the heat so much that he boiled to death, in fact.
All of his flesh and muscles and everything separated from the bone.
And that has nothing to do with punishment anymore. That's pure torture. No. Yeah. So
you
that's
know,
sick. That's the sick part.
And it's sad when they get away with it.
Yeah.
For years, they got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So, again, I want to thank both of you for being on. Abraham, let us know that you'll be coming back on again.
Yeah, well, what time you start?
1 o'clock Eastern time, 1 p.m.
Okay.
Eastern time. What state are you in now?
I'm in Georgia.
Okay, so you're Eastern time as well. Okay,
yeah.
So it'll be from 1 to 2 or 2:30 on Wednesday.
Wednesday, okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, both of you. I really appreciate it. Mariam, I'm looking forward to your book when it comes out, and I'm looking forward to having you back on again.
Thank you, Leona.
Hopefully next Wednesday will be good.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, good for me.
Okay, great. Thank you both for being on tonight. I'm telling you, the information you provided today was unbelievable. It was awesome, though, because it gives us a clear understanding of what goes on in some of these prisons across the country.
Thank you, Leona.
Thank you, Mariam. Thank you, Abraham. We are now
bye-bye, Abraham.
Bye.
Bye.
You should know how to connect with one another, too, I hope, because you can share a lot of information between the two of you.
What was that, what?
Deeper
Justice.com.
Deeperductive.com. Okay.
Deeper Justice. Deeper Justice.
Oh, DeeperJustice.com.
Yeah.
She's on Facebook. Deeper Justice is on Facebook, right?
It's still my old website. It's still functioning. There is a new one in the make, but this one still can be used.
Great.
Okay.
Thank you too.
Thank you both. We are now going to end this episode.